It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Last night's Academy Awards ceremony capped off an eventful year in Hollywood. Last summer, the actors and writers' strikes stopped production of films, and blockbusters like Greta Gerwig's Barbie and Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer brought moviegoers, many of them, back to the theaters. With 13 Oscar nominations, Oppenheimer was favored to win big last night. It did, earning Best Director for Christopher Nolan and the Best Picture Award. But there were some surprises along the way and memorable moments, not all Oppenheimer all the time. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you have a favorite movie or performance from last year? Did it win last night? Do you watch the Oscars every year, or do you just wait for the highlights the next day? What were the big wins or upsets that stood out to you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Rob Thomas is the features editor for the Cap Times. He writes about movies and TV in his Substack newsletter. Not that Rob Thomas. Rob, this Rob Thomas, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having both of us.
Yeah. Now, overall, the ceremony, they try different things from year to year, keeping it on a time schedule, things like that. How did this year's awards shape up for you?
I thought this was the best award ceremony they've had in years. They've been kind of rocky, tried different hosts, tried no hosts, tried different formats. This was a year, I think, and part of it was they just had really good movies that a lot of people were interested in. I thought it was a really entertaining ceremony, and it even ended before 10 o'clock, which you can't you can't fault.
They got an earlier start this year, too.
That's right. Yeah. It started at 6 o'clock, you know, and there's like 10 hours of red carpet before that, I think. But I think that really helped. Another thing I think that really helped was they really limited the montages of like the same clips from the same classic movies that they always do. There was one montage saluting stunts, but other than that, it was pretty focused on the people in the room and the ceremony. I think that was a really smart move to kind of keep the momentum going.
One interesting thing was for the main actor and actress awards, they had past winners do a little spiel about each of the nominees. There was an interesting connection to, you know, the Hollywood history and a kind of a cool way to do it, I thought.
I really love that. They've done that off and on in past years, and I think you know, it's like even if you're one of the four people who don't win, you still get kind of a little, you know, ego jolt because like an actor or actress, maybe somebody you really admire, gives you a, you know, gives you a pep talk and tells you how great you were. Some of them were really great. Like Nicolas Cage was praising Paul Giamatti for being blind throughout the entire shoot of The Holdovers and said, I definitely do that. And some were very heartfelt. And it was just nice, I think, to see those kind of personal connections and you know, I think at this point, who wins and who loses is almost less important than just sort of like celebrating the movies and getting the sense that the people in the audiences have a good time.
Well, let's imagine a particular person in the audience, say, to pick a job at random, radio host.
Okay.
Who used to see a lot more movies, doesn't as much anymore. Maybe they stream episodes of TV shows more than they used to. I think it's me. I'll let the secret out. I think I may be part of a trend there, and Hollywood's got to not like that trend. How did you see this, the crop of movies at the Oscars and the ceremony itself, trying to bring people back to the movies, theater or streaming?
Well, I think they were very smart in seeing that, like, they had a phenomenon last year with Barbenheimer, with Oppenheimer and Barbie. And so Oppenheimer was a clear favorite to win awards, as you said earlier. Barbie got shut out sort of strangely of a couple of nominations. But then the Barbie kind of owned the night. I mean, you had Margot Robbie and Greta Gerwig and America Ferrera in the front row being part of the thing. And then, of course, Ryan Gosling singing I'm Just Ken, which I think was like, I think that's going to be like one of the top 10 Oscar moments. That and the streaker we'll see in 50 years from now in ceremonies. It was so much fun. It was like a karaoke rock concert that even if you hadn't seen any of the movies other than Barbie, like it was so much fun, right? Yeah.
Talking to Rob Thomas from the Cap Times, looking at the Oscars and at movies in general. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you see Oppenheimer? Do you think it was worthy of the pre-Oscar hype and all the awards it won. Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's talk a little bit about Oppenheimer, Rob. So I was looking, it was, I think, the number 5 grossing movie from last year. So pretty solid showing at the theater, but a serious movie. I mean, this seems like the kind of movie that used to win Oscars all the time.
Right, and used to be a big box office hit. Mm-hmm. 10, 20, 30 years ago. So it was a little surprising that a 3-hour R-rated movie about, you know, did so well at the box office as well as critically and at the awards. And I think it's a sign that audiences will come back for a movie like that if it's really well made and interesting and there's sort of a real buzz behind it. You're kind of seeing that now with Dune Part 2, which is a, you know, a fairly bleak R-rated blockbuster, but like, you're seeing all kinds of people going to see it. So, you know, there's a lot of turmoil right now in Hollywood about, as you mentioned, streaming earlier and trying to recover post-pandemic. There was a big labor strike last year, but, you know, these are hopeful signs that, like, if they just make high quality films and present them correctly, that people will come back to the theater.
I want to give a listen now to one of the award winners last night, turning here to Best Supporting Actress category, Divine Joy Randolph. This is like a fun moment in her receiving the award. Here's a little bit of that.
For so long, I've always wanted to be different. And now I realize I just need to be myself. And I thank you. I thank you for seeing me. I have to give a special shout out to my publicist. And I know y'all said don't say nothing about no publicist, but you don't have a publicist like I have a publicist. You have been by my side through the entire thing, and I am forever grateful. I pray to God that I get to do this more than once. I thank you for seeing me.
Set a nice tone there, Rob.
Yes, and the nation's publicist finally get a well-deserved nod, but, you know, yeah, that was all the four acting speeches I thought last night were really good. Like Cillian Murphy's for Best Actor was really good. Emma Stone, I mean, I know she's a great actress, but she seemed genuinely surprised to win. And that was a very emotional speech. And Robert Downey Jr., you know, he obviously owns the room, but he's, you know, had a checkered history, which he kind of alluded to. Mm-hmm. And it was, I thought everybody kind of brought their A game. And, you know, even though some of them felt like foregone conclusions, it was still entertaining to watch.
And then another moment, this is a Best Adapted Screenplay, right? Not always your marquee moment that everybody's watching for. Interesting talk about the movies and the business itself. American Fiction won that award. Here's writer-director Cord Jefferson in his acceptance speech.
I understand that this is a risk-averse industry. I get it. But $200 million movies are also a risk, you know, and it doesn't always work out, but you take the risk anyway. And instead of making one $200 million movie, try making 20 $10 million movies. There are so many people. I just feel so much joy being here. I mean, I felt so much joy making this movie, and I want other people to experience that joy. And they are out there. I promise you, the next Martin Scorsese is out there. The next Greta's out there, both Gretas. The next Christopher Nolan's out there. I promise you, they just want a shot. And we can give them one. And this has changed my life. Thank you all who worked on this movie for trusting a 40-year-old black guy who'd never directed anything before. It has changed my life. Thank you. I love you all. Thank you so much.
So it's been a long cliche that Hollywood wants that one blockbuster hit. They'd rather make one $200 million movie that's going to bring people than roll the dice on a bunch of little ones. What do you think of his philosophy there?
Well, yeah, from his lips to Hollywood's ears, I think. And I think lately that his argument might have a little more traction because we're starting to see some fatigue with all the superhero movies and that used to dominate the multiplexes. There's not that many this year and we're seeing some failures. So hopefully they will see that, like, you know, I mean, there are a lot of different voices out there and most importantly, a lot of audiences will come see these different kind of movies and, you know, and they can sort of smell now when, like, Madame Web was sort of a butt of a couple of jokes last night, a superhero movie that kind of flopped. And audiences, I think, are starting to become savvy and smell when, like, a big blockbuster movie is not all that. And they'll give it a pass, especially since now they can just wait 3 months and see it on streaming. Yeah.
Rob Thomas is with us, features editor at the Cap Times. He writes about movies and TV in his Substack newsletter. Not that Rob Thomas. He's with us for a look at last night's Academy Awards ceremony and the year in movies. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What were your favorite movies from last year? Were they nominated for Oscars? Did your preferred choices win in particular categories? Did you enjoy the production of the event itself? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We are talking about the Oscar Awards ceremony yesterday, looking at the big movies of last year. You could join in with your favorites, your favorite moments from the event itself at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Rob Thomas is with us from the Cap Times. Let's bring on a caller. Ron is with us in Iola. Ron, hi.
Oh, yes. Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Ron. Go ahead.
Well, I may be behind in the times, but why wasn't The Sound of Freedom ever recognized, ever given any credence at all? It was a wonderful film, and it talked about its subject matter was something that is terrifying for young women all over this world.
Ron.
And yet...
I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. No nominations. Now, this is a movie based on a group that works on sex trafficking around the world. It subsequently came under fire for a lot of controversy. The person it was based on ended up leaving the organization, accused of sexual harassment on the job. But this was a movie that I think was number 10. I was looking at the grosses last year, largely because of word of mouth. Rob, your thoughts on that? Why it might not get Oscar recognition?
Yeah, I'm not really sure. I mean, obviously, there was a lot of movies that didn't get mm-hmm. recognized. It might have been the political or the controversy surrounding the film, as you mentioned. I don't really know. I didn't get the chance to see it. So,
gotcha. Ron, thanks a lot for calling in at 800-642-1234. I want to go a little off the beaten path, Rob. You wrote about the animated short films category. Not something that I think people necessarily show up to see, but it's great to see what is out there in the world. People might think animated and a lot of fun. You wrote they're pretty serious this time around.
Yeah, it was every year people ask me, should I take the kids to this one? And this year I was like, do not take the kids to this one, because the winter was War's Over, which was based on the John and Yoko song, and it was a World War One, and that was like the lightest fare of the bunch, and there was, you know, the Holocaust and murderer and all these things, and they were really good and really interesting, but it's funny how that category is sort of turned from like those Pixar shorts that used mm-hmm. to play before the movies to these really sort of challenging movies.
And there were a lot of serious themes in not just that short category, but I mean the big winner, the invention of the atomic bomb and the McCarthy era, things like that. A lot of serious content. Killers of the Flower Moon, also a very dark period in American history. There was a lot of serious stuff in this year's crop of movies.
Yeah, and Zone of Interest in particular, which was the brilliant and really harrowing movie about the Holocaust and was shown in a very different way than usual Holocaust movies, which won Best Sound and Best International Film, and the director gave a pretty impassioned speech about the war in Gaza in his acceptance mm-hmm. speech. And that was, and I think the Best Documentary Feature was about the Ukraine as well. So it was there wasn't a lot of overt politics, like mm-hmm. like Nobody and Oppenheimer really tied that movie to present day, but certainly the movies that were selected, they were. Even, you know, selecting movies that had more serious themes that kind of reflect the times.
Yeah, you mentioned the Best Documentary Feature, 20 Days in Mariupol, recounting the early days of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Here's a director, Mstislav Chernov, talking about why he wished he hadn't had to make the movie.
This is the first Oscar in Ukrainian history. And I'm honored. But probably I will be the first director on this stage who will say, I wish I would never made this film. I wish to be able to exchange this to Russia never attacking Ukraine, never occupying our cities.
Yeah, some very light moments there, but from some pretty serious moments, the ceremony was able to handle both, it seems.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think people really responded to that. And I think, you know, there's been, I remember other years, like during the Iraq war, when they would just like totally tiptoe around politics. Mm-hmm. So I think I felt like last night was like the right amount. And there are also people wearing Free Palestine pins and stuff. And so it's, you know, I think that's how it should be, is people be able to get to speak their mind, especially on a subject such as that. It was very powerful.
Let's go back to our callers. Bridget is with us in Brookfield. Bridget, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was calling because it seemed when they did the memorial, you know, when people passed away, it was so busy. They had the dancers, they had the two gentlemen singing off to the side, and then they're showing the pictures of the people who passed. It was so distracting. It's like you couldn't actually even give a moment to those people, you know, like a moment of silence, you know, like, oh, so-and-so passed away, I didn't know that, or, oh, I really liked him or her, and because I was looking at all of everything else, the dancers, and they, plus they were blocking the screen, kind of.
Bridget, thanks for the call. That Bridget is not alone, Rob. That is one of the most common criticisms I think I've seen of the ceremony last night.
I think that's a very fair criticism, and I don't know why they've done that lately. Rather than having a full screen, they show the orchestra and the dancers, and the screen is in the background, and sort of at some point, like five people were on the screen at the same time, or just a long list of names. They may need to rethink how they do that, because, I mean, it's only going to be more and more people each year. Maybe it needs to be an online-only thing or something. I know they're trying to honor people, but, like, it's almost like doing it halfway is worse than not doing it at all. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the call, Bridget. Kay is with us now in Madison. Kay, hello.
Yes, hi. I was sorry that American Fiction didn't get more awards. I really liked that movie. And Jeffrey, I'm blanking on his last name.
Jeffrey Wright.
Jeffrey Wright, I thought was excellent, but it said so much about stereotypes.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call. Rob, your thoughts on American Fiction?
I really like that movie. I agree. I was really happy it got Best Adapted Screenplay. It was one of those ones where it didn't seem like a front runner for Best Picture or Best Actor, even though Jeffrey Wright was very good. Sterling K. Brown was great, and who was nominated for Best Supporting Actor. And it's I think that movie must be streaming by now. And it's great because it's like this really funny satire, but also like a very touching family drama at the same time. And the fact that Cord Jefferson, the rare director, is able to balance those things was really unusual and interesting. I do highly recommend that movie.
Thanks, Kay, for the call. Talking to Rob Thomas from the Cap Times about last night's Oscars. We heard from Matt in Appleton, who says the Ryan Gosling Ken bit was a tip of the hat to Buzzley Berkeley classic Hollywood. Here's a listen.
I'm just Ken.
Not hitting all the notes there, Ryan, but the onstage shtick was pretty good.
I can't imagine another actor doing that. Like, I mean, he's nominated, so he's got to have some degree of nerves that night, even though that was after that his category. And to, like, get in front of, you know, the world and your peers and just belt it out like that with such conviction and such humor. I mean, I think that is one of, like, the all-time great Oscar moments.
Thanks a lot for that email. I want to talk, Rob, a little bit about, okay, so people are looking back at last year. If there were movies that they missed, which are the ones at the top of their list, of your list, for them to catch up on?
Well, the Oscars, I really, and I was late to this too, but Past Lives, which was nominated for Best Picture, is a fantastic movie. And I'm not sure if that's on one of the streamers yet, but Greta, that's a really great movie, and I highly recommend it. Sort of a bittersweet, not really a love triangle, but about this woman who's sort of torn between her past and present. And what else would I pick that was really good? Yeah, I'm sort of blanking at the moment, I think. Yeah.
Sure. Well, so what are you watching for now? Here we are, 2024. What are you watching for, either when it comes to individual movies or maybe trends from what we saw the Oscars last night that you're watching for more of?
Well, it'll be interesting because, you know, we had the writers and actor strikes last year, which shut down production for 5 months. So this might be a year with not as many movies at the Cineplex. So I'm hoping that this means there's more opportunity for more international films. Like Godzilla Minus One was a surprise hit. It actually made more money here than it did in this native Japan. And I would love to see this being an opportunity where if there's fewer blockbusters this summer, people will go back out and check out some things like that might not have gotten the platform they did otherwise.
And one thing that has been a weird financial trend is Hollywood completes a movie. There's a Wile E. Coyote movie, a Batgirl movie, and then doesn't release it. Apparently for tax reasons or whatever, they actually do better in some cases than releasing a movie. Do you feel offended, like, knowing that there is a movie more or less in the can that we just can't see?
It's horrifying. I mean, I feel so bad for the filmmakers who work so hard, or their movies that, like, or TV shows even, that don't do well, and they just get canceled off streaming, and they just don't exist anymore. And hopefully, like that Coyote versus Acme movie you mentioned, there's been such a backlash to that that I'm hoping the studios and the streamers will, you know, not want to take that negative attention and we'll finally release it, right?
Yeah. Weirdly, I want to see it more than I would have.
Absolutely.
If it had just been in the theater.
Yeah, why are you keeping it from us? Yeah.
Rob, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, I loved it. Thanks.
That's Rob Thomas, features editor at The Cap Times. He writes about movies and TV in his Substack newsletter. You can look it up. It's called Not That Rob Thomas. Apparently, there's some other, I guess, kind of famous Rob Thomas in pop culture. I don't know nothing about that. We've been talking about memorable moments from last night's Academy Awards ceremony and a little bit about the future of movies. Still time for you to share your favorite movies of the last year, Oscar quality or not. Email us, ideas@WPR.org. Again, that's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Earlier this month, the CDC released new isolation guidelines for people who test positive for COVID-19 and now matches more closely public health advice for respiratory illnesses like the flu and RSV. A public health specialist joins us now to break down what led to that change and how it could impact the spread of the virus in the future. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What have you been doing to keep yourself and others healthy during the respiratory virus season? What do you think about the CDC's updated recommendations? Have you changed the way you recover after getting sick when it comes to how long you stay out of, say, work or keep a kid home from school or fill in the blank? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Ajay Sethi is a professor of population health sciences, faculty director of the Masters of Public Health program at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Ajay, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Nice to be here.
Well, can you talk us through the latest guidelines from the CDC?
Yeah, so the latest guidelines are asking people to be more mindful of their symptoms in deciding when they should be in isolation versus leave their house and still take precautions to avoid spreading any germs to other people. The previous guidance, held sort of this requirement that everybody, regardless of symptoms, after testing positive for COVID, would, you know, stay at home for a minimum of 5 days. But the reality is people experience COVID differently. So they've asked people now to think about their symptoms and stay at home as long as you're ill. And once when you start to get better, Once when the fever is gone without any medications, wait another day, and then you can take yourself out of isolation.
Now, when it comes to public health guidelines, how much of this is, okay, this is what we know absolutely about stopping transmission of disease versus this is what we know about how much people will actually listen to us and take our advice and try to find a happy medium there?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. And, you know, there's also a chicken and egg moment here where people for a long time now have been deciding for themselves what sort of protective measures they'll take for themselves and how they'll protect people around them. You know, we don't see masks nearly as much as we did 2-3 years ago. And that's true with isolation and testing as well. But at the same time, I think what we don't remind ourselves enough is that there's a lot of immunity out there. Estimates are that 98% of people have either been vaccinated, have had COVID, or both. And with that growing immunity comes an opportunity to rethink how we manage COVID at a community level.
These new guidelines kind of lump COVID-19 in with other respiratory illnesses like influenza, the flu, or RSV. They're different. They have different consequences and symptoms. What do you think of the logic behind kind of just wrapping them into one bundle of recommendation?
Yeah, it's more pragmatic. It also, I think, follows the way people think and kind of approach symptoms. Before COVID, you never really heard about people testing at home for a respiratory virus. We didn't have tests largely available for that purpose. When COVID emerged and the test became available and then widely distributed, it became the habit for many people, but not all. And today, I think most people don't even bother testing. Most people don't, but some people might still have those at home. So by thinking about this as any respiratory virus, the precautions are going to be the same. You don't want to spread it to others. So staying at home is a good idea, especially if you can, and wearing a mask around others, regardless of the pathogen, is a good idea to protect people around you.
One of the recommendations is for that person, you know, they've had COVID or one of the other illnesses we're talking about, they're over it, they go back to work or what have you. One of the suggestions is try to make sure that the environment is better ventilated. So opening windows, if that's possible. I heard people early on with COVID saying, hey, maybe we as a society should tackle our indoor airspace and our ventilation and things like that. Have we done that with these diseases in mind, do you think?
It's improved. COVID reminded us that ventilation does matter, and there are engineers who are working with people who manage buildings to improve airflow. But that sort of infrastructure improvement takes more time than, you know, recommending new behaviors for people to follow. So it's happening, but it's not happening fast enough, if you will.
We're talking to Ajay Sethi with the Public Health Program at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We're talking about updated guidelines from the CDC on when you can go back amongst people after COVID or flu or RSV, new kind of looser guidelines, taking away that, hey, you should stay at home for 5 days concept. You could join in with your thoughts on that, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. One question I have, Ajay, is, you know, some people will get COVID and they'll know it. They'll have some pretty serious symptoms and that'll lead them to get tested. Some people, especially if vaccinated or if they've had it before, might have it with lesser symptoms. How much are we seeing COVID being caught by people but never noticed, never tested for?
Yeah, that's a property of the virus, which has, from the very beginning, made this very difficult to control. The ability for someone to be infected, to be infectious, and not even be aware of their illness. Maybe they'll get symptoms a few days later, even though they're infectious now, and maybe they'll never get symptoms. So that's a property of the virus that's still in effect. And now that we have more immunity, I think we probably see a lot more of that, where symptoms are so mild, and yet people are carrying the virus and potentially spreading it to others. It's very difficult to measure. You'd have to recruit people and test them almost every day to figure out how often that happens. It's hard to estimate. And again, if we think back about these guidelines and how they've become more pragmatic, the reality is from the very beginning, people have been spreading this virus without knowing it.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Kathleen is with us in Madison. Kathleen, hi.
Hello. I'm nearly 71 years old. I've been 100% homebound for 4 years now and counting because of COVID, because I have a chronic respiratory illness. It's not diagnosable. It's not treatable, but it is severe. And so here I am. I've had to give up a lot of aspects of my life that I used to enjoy and make the best of what I've got left, like pretty much 100% online, you know, that I can do sitting at home.
Kathleen, I'm sorry to hear that. Thank you, though, for sharing your story. And Ajay, Kathleen pointing toward one of the biggest concerns I've seen about these new guidelines is for people with something like a chronic respiratory condition or an immune system problem, something that renders them particularly vulnerable to COVID, even maybe with vaccinations. Some people saying these new guidelines will fall short of protecting us.
Well, what it is so one, I agree with you. I feel badly for people like Kathleen who have underlying conditions that put them at risk for having a severe bout of COVID if they were to get COVID. And when you look at the data of people who are hospitalized with COVID, they tend to be older and they tend to be people who are immunocompromised or have, you know, underlying conditions. That's in whom the disease is more concentrated, severe disease is more concentrated. And for them, you know, protecting them is very important. And so family members who are healthier certainly should be wearing a mask around those who are vulnerable for severe COVID. Definitely stay away altogether if they have COVID at the time. And that's something that's going to be, you know, from this point forward, really important for individuals. It's not even just COVID, but also RSV in older adults is not necessarily a great thing to get. And influenza, we've always known older adults are more vulnerable to severe influenza.
Kathleen, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And that reminds me also, Ajay, as I understand it, these new guidelines from the CDC, they're not here talking about a hospital or a senior care facility. The precautions there will be a little more rigorous, hopefully.
Yeah, that's right. So these guidelines, these updated guidelines apply to community settings, and healthcare settings have their own operating guidelines that are, you know, built on the foundations of infection control. And so those will be in place, and those are separate.
We're talking to Ajay Sethi, professor of population health sciences at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the new simplified COVID isolation guidelines released by the CDC. They also apply to the flu and RSV. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been sick with a respiratory virus this year, COVID or otherwise? What kind of isolation or masking guidelines did you follow? Were you able to figure out, based on the information out there, what were you supposed to do in the first place? What questions do you have about the current state of COVID and these new CDC guidelines? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Ajay Sethi, professor of population health sciences at UW's School of Medicine and Public Health. We're talking about the recently updated COVID-19 recommendations from the CDC and how to keep yourself and others healthy. Those guidelines also apply to the flu and RSV, saying watch your symptoms, take precautions as you start to go back, but taking away the hard 5-day isolation suggestion. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a loved one especially vulnerable to complications from something like COVID-19? Have you taken extra steps to keep yourself and others safe? What are your thoughts, your questions about the CDC's guidelines on these illnesses? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Cedarburg. Jim, hi.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. Good show as always. Yeah, I go back to earlier time when we were just coming off those deadly childhood diseases like measles, and the vaccines were new, and things like polio. And so parents were extra, extra cautious when kids got sick. We're talking about young kids and their ear infections and the like. So I was fortunate, either my grandmother or, you know, my mom was able to take care of me at home. We did not go to school for maybe a week until we were really, you know, really well again.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Ajay, I don't know if we have data on this, but have we changed in our attitudes toward when we can send kids to school when they're sick?
Well, you know, that those sort of things are very different from place to place. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, you know, affording childcare is not an option for people. So kids often do get sent to school despite being sick, maybe with mild illness. Luckily, you know, with childhood immunizations, especially the ones that are required for attendance in school, you know, rates are pretty good. Generally, we've had some sort of setbacks in the last couple of years, particularly with measles. But they're generally pretty good, and hopefully we'll head in a more positive direction moving forward.
Jim, thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Ajay, let's talk some more about vaccines. I think we've been talking, you and I, for a couple of years now on, you know, will COVID, with the main strains of COVID, change too fast for vaccines to keep up? How much will we have to reformulate vaccines? What are you seeing now in that that arms race, vaccine versus the virus that causes COVID?
Yeah, so, well, we know now that boosters are recommended, and we've had an update to what booster is provided to people a couple of times now. And I think a couple of things are clear. Looks like boosters are going to be needed for the foreseeable future for this virus. The evolution is pretty rapid, quicker than we'd maybe expected when it first emerged 4 years ago. So boosters will be important. And you may have heard last week, the CDC was recommending an additional booster for anybody who's over 65 or vulnerable for severe disease. So maybe more frequent boosters for people who are in those categories, and one booster for everybody else. I'll say you may be aware that not enough people are getting boosted. I think if you've had COVID fairly recently or maybe at all, you might assume that you can forego the vaccine because you had COVID and got immunity that way. But the data show that people who are hospitalized are less likely to have been vaccinated. And so getting boosted is important. And overall, less than a quarter of all adults in the United States have gotten their latest booster. And even when you get to people who are 65 years and older, so the more vulnerable, not even half, about 42% have received their latest booster. So we can do a better job there.
I want to put numbers into context a little bit, Ajay. I saw reading up today, last year, 75,000 fatalities attributed to COVID, which looks really good compared to, you know, 250,000 or hundreds of thousands in previous years. On the other hand, like a 75,000 fatalities from a flu season in a year, that'd be a pretty bad flu season. Where do you put those numbers? How do you put those numbers into context?
Yeah, I mean, it's still high. And because we have vaccines and we don't, you know, get enough uptake of vaccines, I think that number will be lower if we can promote vaccination better. At the same time, you know, 2 years ago, mm-hmm. even last year, COVID was like almost the third leading cause of death in the United States. In 2023, it was the 10th leading cause of death, and maybe close to 11 right now. So that's a lot of progress. It's still an unacceptably high number of deaths simply because there's a vaccine that's effective and available, and because not enough people have been vaccinated or fully boosted.
Let's go back to our callers. Mike is with us now in Slinger. Mike, hello.
Yes, speaking of boosters, I'm 75. I had a booster shot in November, and I would be eligible again in 3 months, I'm assuming. Are there going to be any summer boosters, or are we going to have to wait again until November, October, somewhere in there?
All right, Mike, thanks for the call. So Mike in his 70s, Ajay, what are the current recommendations there?
Yeah, so just last week, an advisory committee advised the CDC, and they adopted that recommendation that Mike or anybody in that age group can get an additional booster and doesn't have to wait until the fall. I too got my booster in November. I'm not eligible for an additional booster. But I'll say it's been shown that those antibodies do wane maybe around 6 months after that booster. So if you're vulnerable for severe disease, it's a good idea to get another shot and talk to your doctor about that.
Mike, thanks again for the call. Ajay Sethi is with us from UW's School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the latest CDC guidelines on COVID precautions, along with RSV and the flu. Ajay, how bad a flu season has this been?
It's average. It could be a lot worse. Mm-hmm. Flu has been circulating. I think a lot of people who had symptoms, respiratory symptoms, and perhaps tested for COVID and tested negative may have learned that they had the flu or maybe just assumed it. RSV has been around, and rhinoviruses and other things. But flu has not been insignificant like it was in those early years of the COVID pandemic. It has returned, and it's not quite gone yet. So this is where thinking about respiratory symptoms as a whole is a good idea. If you're not protecting yourself against COVID, you can protect yourself against the other pathogens.
And let's talk about the other vaccines. The flu vaccine, they come out every year in the fall. What has uptake been on vaccines in the COVID era for the flu?
Yeah, this year not as great as we've seen in previous years. And we luckily are seeing the typical pattern that older individuals are more likely to get vaccinated against flu than younger individuals. And that's always been the case. So at least we see that pattern. But overall, the uptake is a little lower than it was pre-COVID. So we have improvement there. And what's nice about this year's flu vaccine is that it turned out to be a pretty good match with what was circulating. So it's a missed opportunity for people who don't get vaccinated.
And then there's the least familiar of the group we're talking about, I think, Ajay, RSV, respiratory syncytial virus. I believe I have that right.
Syncytial, yeah.
So, thank you. Tell us a little bit about what that is and who is eligible to get and should get vaccinated for that.
Yeah, so adults 60 years and older are eligible to get an RSV vaccine. Adults are going to be more likely to have severe RSV infection if they caught that virus. And especially with older ages and, again, people with underlying conditions. So that vaccine has been recommended since the fall. And I don't know what those numbers are for uptake, but as with a lot of vaccines, the uptake can be a little slow. And I'm not sure if everybody is aware of that that vaccine. Kids, have been getting RSV infection coming out of the COVID pandemic, those years of sort of more isolation. And so we've seen more RSV illness in recent years, and we'll hopefully see that go away a little bit more in the future.
And Ajay, for people out there, getting back to at-risk people, if someone out there listening is at a higher risk for these kind of respiratory illnesses or someone in their family is, what are some of the things that they can either do to take precautions or maybe should be in touch with their doctor about?
Yeah, so number one would be being up to date on all the vaccines that are available. They've been approved because they're effective. And the older you are, the more effective they are for you because you're your underlying risk for severe illness. Also, just the good old hand washing and practicing good hygiene and cleaning up the environment around you is always helpful. And also having conversations with family members and people, letting them know that if they have symptoms, they prefer not to be exposed to their illness. And, before COVID, I think it was probably like people wore it with a badge of honor to show up to work with those respiratory illnesses, feeling like they were, working hard. And I think the culture's changed a little bit. There's a lot more mindfulness and understanding that spreading illness to others is not kind. And so hopefully we can continue that trend and people can, be willing to share with others. Say, hey, I'm vulnerable to severe illness. Could you please cover your cough or wear a mask or just not be around me?
Ajay, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Ajay Sethi, Professor of Population Health Sciences and Faculty Director of the Masters of Public Health Program at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us today for a look at the recently updated COVID-19 recommendations from the CDC, what that change means for public health. still time for you to share your story. If you've done something to change your level of precautions when it comes to these respiratory illnesses, COVID-19 and others, or if there's a question you'd like us to tackle in the future, either on a talk show or for our news team, we'd sure love to hear from you. You can email us ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Send in your questions. We can try to find some answers for you. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, walleye is a favorite fish and favorite dish here in Wisconsin, but warming waters could affect their future in the state. Find out more tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. I moved to a new place last month. It was a long time since my last move, so it was a fair amount of work. But it could have been worse. At least I didn't have to move 4 million things. As reported by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the Milwaukee Public Museum is getting ready to move to its new location. The new site isn't scheduled to open for 3 years, but staff is starting to pack now. Why are they getting so far ahead? One, they have a lot of stuff. Like I said, 4 million items. Can't really wait until the last minute to pack that much. And B, it's a museum, so lots of that stuff is museum stuff. So it requires special treatment. It could be fragile, hard to repair, need to be in a special environment. So my technique of randomly throwing last-minute stuff into bags and boxes, it's not going to work. Hey, speaking of boxes, I have a bunch to get rid of after that move. Milwaukee Public Museum, if you're listening, you need some boxes, let me know. Throw in some pizza, I'll help you pack. You know, the less breakable stuff. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, find out how private equity funds have taken over American newspapers and what that means for our local communities and for democracy. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Madison business owner as part of a series we're airing this month on women in southern Wisconsin in partnership with Midwest Mujeres.
Angela Morgan of Madison was feeling uninspired in her job a few years back. It was too rigid.
I actually was used to working in customer service. So I was always in an office, always on a phone, always behind a desk. And I was like, this does not fit my life. This does not fit my personality. And I miss my kids, you know?
Morgan says she decided to take a huge risk. She started her own business, Food Junkies Catering. Morgan considers herself an eclectic chef. She'll make anything for her customers. Beef, fish, vegan dishes. But Morgan's favorite meal to cater?
Tacos.
Who doesn't love a taco?
Exactly.
They make everyone so happy.
And they come in so many different variations, right? Mm-hmm. Like, actually, that was the first thing that I started selling was jerk chicken tacos. And then I noticed, like, you're making, like, $400 a day. So it's a staple in my business, the jerk chicken tacos and a jerk chicken salad. So those are the two things that people are, like, running me down in the street about.
I talked with Morgan about this as part of a storytelling partnership with Midwest Mujeres in Madison. After making me very hungry for tacos, Morgan told me more about what drives her in her work and in her personal life.
My motto for life, people and things will come and go. Always stay true to you. I started this business to generate extra income, be creative, and to spend more time with my children. Plot twist, I didn't see much of them for the first 2 years.
But now, business is consistent for Morgan, and she sees her daughters more often.
I have two daughters named Cameron and Zora. My daughters are my rocks and my headaches. I absolutely love them.
Morgan says they appreciate what she does and help her out with catering.
Being a mother and a business owner has taught me balance. As they grow, I am showing them and teaching them what it means to sacrifice, to work hard, to watch your money, and to have fun. My ultimate dream for them is to use my work ethic to follow their own dreams, because this one's mine.
She says Food Junkie's success has had a positive impact on her family.
They're so proud of me. That's been the biggest thing. We've had a challenging life, you know, being a single parent, having to move around, you know, not really having the support that we needed. And so for them to look at me now like that, like a local celebrity, is like, Oh, mom's that girl.
And now, the mother and daughters are working on another project together, a family and friends cookbook.
Well, my daughter just turned 21, and she's always talking to me about her generation and how they don't really have what our generation had, right? They're not standing in the kitchen with us watching grandma cook, so they're like, can you put us together a cookbook or something, like something that's really simple that we can make good meals? They're young parents. They want to feed their kids good food.
And Morgan will keep feeding her customers. She dreams of expanding Food Junkies Catering, adding barbecue, or one day owning a food truck.
I see nothing but great things in the future for myself and for my children. Just making sure I'm sticking to my guns, that my mindset is always where it needs to be, and that I have enough courage to execute what I know. So I'm good.
Angela Morgan shared her story with us as part of a partnership with Midwest Mujeres in Madison. We've partnered with the organization to share stories of women who live in southern Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast and find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. The newspaper business in the U.S. is in the midst of a crisis. According to Northwestern University's Local News Initiative and its State of Local News 2023 report, the U.S. has lost more than 2,900 newspapers since 2005, and many surviving newspapers have had a steady run of layoffs and service cuts. Why? One common theory, the internet took away advertising and classified revenue. Our next guest says that's part of the puzzle, but in a new book, she says there's a bigger story we're missing, the takeover of media outlets by hedge funds and private equity firms. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about ownership of newspapers? Do you still read a local or national paper in print or online? Have you noticed the coverage change for better or worse over time? Have you lost your local paper? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Margo Suska is Assistant Professor of Journalism, Accountability, and Democracy in the School of Communication at American University in Washington, D.C. Her new book is called Hedged: How Private Investment Funds Help Destroy American Newspapers and Undermine Democracy. Margo, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me, Rob.
Margo, people might be able to name, you know, their local newspaper, lots of other papers, maybe even some of the chains that operate them. You trace another layer in the corporate pyramid there. How much have these hedge funds and private equity companies bought into newspapers?
Well, their influence over the last 20 years has been substantial, even though they may not be operating as owners. They have been operating as lenders. They've put pressure on newspaper managers at publicly traded chains like Gannett, which of course owns the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. So the influence of these private equity firms and hedge funds over the last 20 years has been both substantial as well as devastating in the U.S. newspaper market. And I tried with this book to look at not just the chains, but to look at these, you know, these private firms, these Wall Street firms that were kind of calling the shots, to really trace even before the internet and before the 2008 Great Recession, to try to determine how much influence they had over the destruction of the U.S. newspaper market.
And you trace the history of newspapers in the United States, and you point out that some sort of commercial interest has been there all along. The form has changed over that time, though. But there's something you say in this modern, the private equity companies investing in newspapers, that's been particularly damaging. Why is that?
Well, I think that, and I mentioned in the book that, you know, going back to the colonial period of U.S. newspapers, when Benjamin Franklin owned a newspaper in Philadelphia, profit has long been a part of U.S. newspapers, and it's gone hand in hand. People may know the names Pulitzer and Hearst. You know, these were men who got very wealthy off of their newspaper ownership in the late 19th and 20th century. But there's something much different about having these private Wall Street firms so heavily invested in the newspaper market. And I think that that is the very nature of their business, which is profit for the sake of profit. And they care very little about the mission of a news organization operating in a community, whether or not that's Milwaukee, whether or not that's a small county, you know, Beaver County, Pennsylvania, or whether or not that's, you know, a rural community in Idaho. Their mission is profit. Their mission is not community news and information. And it's certainly not investigative, accountability-driven work that is very expensive, that takes trained reporting staff. And, you know, in Boise, Idaho, after a hedge fund bought the McClatchy chain, they refused to even pay for Microsoft Excel to be put on an investigative journalist's computer there. I mean, that's, you know, that'll cost you about $100. And this is a firm that traffics in hundreds of millions of dollars. So I think the difference between the profit of, you know, historically profit in the U.S. newspaper market in these last 20 years is that there is no sense of mission. There is no sense of the role that a newspaper plays in a community. And they are just trying to liquidate and extract as much as they can. And the results, you know, they're having, the consequences are very destructive.
Talking to Margot Suska about her new book, Hedged, How Private Investment Funds Help Destroy American Newspapers and Undermine Democracy. And Margot, you point out that this came along in a vulnerable time. I mentioned the whole internet taking away some ad revenue for newspapers, which was real. You, I think, are making the argument in the book that newspapers largely could have weathered that storm if they had invested, if they'd kept up with the times. And then this cost-cutting, profit-taking mentality, you say, from hedge funds and others, stopped that from happening. Spell out a little bit about how those two things collided.
Yeah, I think that it's become almost conventional wisdom that the loss of advertising revenue is what felled U.S. newspaper chains. And I was really interested when I started doing research for the book in early 2018 to really look at the executive decision-making that was going on, you know, at that time. What was happening in the early 2000s and in the mid-2000s as the internet was becoming more important, both for readers as well as for advertising. And when we talk about advertising, we're talking about sites like Craigslist, Monster.com, that instead of paying for an ad if you wanted to sell your car, you know, you were going to put it on Craigslist. But this idea that, you know, the internet felled newspapers, you know, Craigslist was not a very sophisticated site. Newspapers with some investment could have competed with Craigslist. Newspapers essentially had a monopoly on advertising, but there was no innovation. So these newspaper chains, many of which were beholden to private equity investors, they made the decision rather than to innovate in the 2000s. They made the decision to choose mergers and acquisitions as a strategy to handle, you know, the digital transition, which was, they thought, bigger would be better. And of course, what happened is you saw massive debt got piled on as the 2008 recession came on, as the loss of advertising became more acute. And then what happened were newsroom layoffs, reporters were cut, and the very product that they were promising readers, which was a local newspaper, was cut to the bone. So what happened was audiences turned away from the local newspaper because they started charging more for a product that offered less. So I kind of traced this cycle of, you know, the decision making to merge and acquire, the debt, the layoffs, and how audiences said we just stopped seeing any real value in a newspaper that just kept getting more expensive. And it's a really unfortunate reality, all of which can be traced back at many of the chains that I studied, to private equity investors.
We're talking to Margot Suska about her new book. It's called Hedged: How Private Investment Funds Helped Destroy American Newspapers and Undermine Democracy. And we'll get to that part of the story in just a bit. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? Have you lost a newspaper, or has a newspaper in your community been cut way, way back? Have you worked in a local newsroom through all of this? How has your work been impacted? Did you see that buyout by a company that, as far as you knew, didn't have anything to do with journalism or the media? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Margot Suska, Assistant Professor of Journalism, Accountability, and Democracy in the School of Communication at American University. Her new book is called Hedged: How Private Investment Funds Help Destroy American Newspapers and Undermine Democracy. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Okay, Margot, so we've got hedge funds and other private equity groups buying interests in or control of newspapers, layoffs, massive service cuts. Let's get to the next part. I think the part that worries you the most, actually, the effect of this on American democracy and communities. What impact do these changes have?
Well, there have been other researchers who have studied what the loss of local news means, and that means an increase in political polarization, an increase in voter apathy, and a disengagement from the political processes in those communities. Research that I've just started doing is looking at where people are going in the void left behind. And I talk a little bit about this in the book, but I've gotten more interested in this. And I was just talking to someone in Miami about the loss of the cuts to El Nuevo Herald, which is the Spanish newspaper, kind of the sister paper to the Miami Herald, and they're both owned by a hedge fund. And based on those cuts, this person I was talking to said the Spanish-speaking audiences are turning away from El Nuevo Herald, and they're finding AM radio as the alternative and WhatsApp as the alternative. And those are both rife with misinformation and disinformation. And in an election year, you know, that loss of, you know, of verified, accurate information provided by trained reporters and moving into a space with, you know, a real cesspool of information is going to have real consequences, not just in Miami, but everywhere that you're seeing a loss of local journalism. And I think that's, you know, really where I get concerned is, who is filling the void left by local newspapers, and where are people going to get their information? Certainly they're turning to social media sites, you know, Facebook pages, WhatsApp. Out in California, Chevron, the oil company, now owns and operates and runs and has for a decade its own website that's made to look like a local newspaper website. You know, that is a really troubling consequence, I think, of the loss of local news. Who gets to control the narrative? Who gets to set the agenda? And, you know, what are citizens expected to understand about the community they live? You know, think of climate change, think of voter information that you need to have access to. These are all really, really, you know, troubling issues that the loss of local news has, you know, kind of reared its head. For me, the other issue that I give some attention to in the book is that these private equity firms and hedge funds also have an interest in many other sectors of the economy, for-profit hospitals, for-profit nursing homes. They're going to start to get into the childcare industry. So I'm also worried about the loss of local journalism holding these types of companies, not to mention government officials who take money from them, accountable. You know, who will be a voice for regular citizens on the ground when these billionaire firms, you know, have just not only have they gotten their hands into so many other sectors of the economy, but they now have such a, you know, a deep control over the U.S. newspaper market.
Let's bring on a caller. John is with us in Arcadia. John, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, John?
I used to deliver the newspapers. I had a motor route out in the rural area of Wisconsin and Minnesota from Winona up to Wabasha on the Minnesota side, and then from Nelson, Wisconsin to Fountain City on the Wisconsin side. I had 135 customers, and the paper at that time, it was 2015. I believe it was 50 cents a copy. And by the time 2019 rolled around, the newspaper was selling for $2.50 a copy. And I lost everything but 55 customers. And all I was making was enough money to put in the gas tank. I only got a quarter of paper.
John, thanks for the call. Not a lot of time left. I believe I know the paper John's talking about, and there was a buyout involved in there. Margo, John providing one small example of what's happening at a lot of, especially mid-sized, small to mid-sized city papers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's in. You mentioned the state of local news report that came out of Northwestern University. In that report, they mentioned that Wisconsin is one of the three states that's lost the most newspapers per capita compared to the current number of residents in the state. So, you know, Wisconsin is really going through, has gone through a loss. And, you also, when you have a company like Gannett, which is beholden to a number of private equity institutional investors and debt to others, that raises some real issues, with the how many reporters you have who are doing crucial work at the local, regional, and state level.
John, thanks for the call. Margo, in just our last minute or so, point us toward a way out.
Well, I would say to your, if anyone is listening, that they should continue to support Wisconsin Public Radio and also nonprofit sites like Wisconsin Watch. I think that many of us are putting a lot of hope in the rising nonprofit news ecosystem that tries to remove these vulture hedge funds and private equity firms from the news ecosystem. But it's going to take a real effort from citizens to get active and understand that it's going to require their financial support.
And briefly, are there any regulatory changes that could straighten things out as you see it?
Well, I think that there could be antitrust reform. I think that the Federal Communications Commission also needs to get back involved in putting more limitations on ownership. But all of those rules have effectively been rolled back over the course of the last 20 years. So, yes, I think that that's part of my concern, is that at every turn, these firms have been allowed to grow more powerful, and you have federal regulatory, legislative, and judicial system that's just looked the other way.
Margo, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Margo Seska, Assistant Professor of Journalism, Accountability, and Democracy at the School of Communication at American University. Her new book is called Hedged: How Private Investment Funds Helped to Destroy American Newspapers and Undermine Democracy. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, unintentional injuries and deaths are common, from work sites to roadways, but they are preventable. That's according to the author of the book, There Are No Accidents, The Deadly Rise of Injury and Disaster, Who Profits and Who Pays the Price. And maple syrup season came early to Wisconsin this year because of a warm winter. We'll look into the state's syrup production, how it's done, and you could join in with your questions, maybe your experiences. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.